Hello, everybody. I'm Kevin Winder, and thanks for tuning in to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. And as always, I have a question for you. When you hear the term ex-evangelical, do you imagine a person who has lost their way, left their religion, or has become free from religious overreach? In today's podcast, I have the privilege of interviewing Sarah McCammon, NPR political correspondent and author of The Ex-Evangelicals. Join us now as we learn a bit more about Sarah's work and explore what might be behind this exodus from mainline religions. Hello, I'm Kevin Winder, and I'd like to say a few words and introduce myself to you if you're new to this podcast or my work. I became an ex-evangelical, so to speak, in 2012 when I left my position as executive pastor at a local church in Denver. Since that time, I've been serving people online who have big questions about God and life and theology and the Bible and all the stuff in between, and who also find themselves at great odds with religion and the overreach of institutional power. I've deconstructed a lot of this, but for the purpose of reconstruction. I've offered a weekly blog since 2012, and that's called Thrive in Exile. And since 2015, I've offered a weekly podcast entitled Beyond Everything Radio. You can learn more about my books, my uncoaching, my courses, all of which are free. And you can get in touch with me at my website, kevinwinder.com. Remember, I spell my name like the number 7. And while there, consider subscribing to my newsletter called Winder's Windshield. And now back to the program, and thank you for tuning in. And thanks so much for coming back to yet another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. And today is a special edition. We have a guest in studio. Well, not totally in studio, a Zoom studio, because as you guys know, I broadcast from my clawfis. And, and Sarah is here. Sarah McCammon is a national political correspondent for NPR and the co-host of NPR Politics Podcast, if you didn't know her name. Now, she focuses on some really interesting work in the political, social, and cultural arenas of America, specifically between politics and religion. So that is going to be a part of our discussion today. She covers political events. She recently covered the RNC, among many other things. And this just gives Sarah a really unique boots-on-the-ground perspective of the American people as she seeks to understand and report on all of our varying ideologies and perspectives. So for those of you who are not aware, Sarah recently published a book entitled The Ex-Evangelicals, which is now a New York Times bestseller. And when I read it, I was truly inspired to just reach out to her and see if she was willing to have a dialogue with me. So many pieces in this book just kind of rang my bell. And of course, I picked up the audio and it was like she read it to me. So my experience is I know her far better than she knows me. But I was truly inspired to reach out. And to my delight, here she is. She is our guest today. And I'd like to welcome Sarah McCammon to Beyond Everything Radio.
Thanks so much, Kevin. And I laughed when you said clawfis, because as somebody who broadcasted during the pandemic as a public radio journalist, I definitely have had a few clawfises. So
yes,
in different places.
Yeah. So yeah, I have an office. Some people don't know this, but I've done some videos that nobody watched. So I took my office, has a closet, and I covered it with sound deadening, material and created a desk and a little podcast studio in here. And I love it. It's like my little happy place, and now you're in it too. So thank you for coming. Well, Sarah, I want to dive right in and I want to talk about your book. This book has taken fire. It is the New York Times bestseller, among other probably credentials that it's gaining as we speak. Some you could probably speak to better than me. I'm curious if we could start out. I want to just tell you a brief story. As I was reading it, I didn't even get two chapters in before I was sending the link to dozens and dozens of people, okay? And some of the feedback came back, oh, look at that title, White Evangelicals. It just sounds like one of those conservative jabs, right? And so I want to address the title first. And what would you say to some of those conservative audience members who can't get over that? Like they just see this as kind of a trendy word and not really understanding the research that you put in that kind of unfolds out of this book.
Yeah, no, I understand why some people would react that way. And I'll say a couple of things about that. I mean, I wrestled with the subtitle. I mean, the title, The Ex-Evangelicals, was always what I wanted to call it, because that term had kind of caught fire online and just I thought succinctly kind of summed up a very simple idea about being part of a community and then no longer being part of it. But I've had people from a variety of faith backgrounds, including, Christians from like Black churches and people from even other faith traditions, tell me that they resonate with a lot of things in the book. So I don't think it's just about white churches, but you can't, if you look at the data when it comes to voting and when it comes to the way that churches are often kind of de facto segregated to a large degree, not 100%. And there have been a lot of efforts to change that, which I write about. I remember those really well from my own church growing up. But the reality is still not that different from what Dr. King described in the 1960s about the Sunday morning hour being so segregated. I mean, I think there has been progress since then, but not as much as I think even a lot of white pastors and churchgoers would like to see. And there are a lot of different reasons for that. And those are complicated and they go to, I think, a really complicated and painful history. And so I wanted to be sure that I was being precise. And that's why I chose to include the word white in the subtitle, because the history and culture and sort of political battles of the what predominantly white evangelical church is it's just different from, the Black church, which has its own history. And it's not meant to be an attack. It's meant to be specific. What am I actually talking about here? And so I'm always gratified when I hear from people from other traditions or other racial backgrounds who say they resonate with things in the book, because I think it does speak to a wide variety of people. But I also wanted to be very clear about, like, I'm talking about what I lived and what I have researched. And
Yeah, and
so.
you have done a lot of research, and if that t subtitle is hanging anybody up in this audience, get over yourself. Get a copy of it. She does have for a limited time now a very low-cost e-version, which you could download like immediately. And I got to tell you, get over it, because when she builds out her case, when she walks you through the history of evangelicalism, it's really an opportunity for people to have a self-critical examination. And that is a healthy process. It's not, like you say, it's not an attack. It's not an erosion. It's not just throwing everything under the bus. But your experience resonates. I'm sure the reason it's so po that the book is so popular is because it resonates with so many people who sat there week after week in the pew asking the same kinds of questions that you had, going through the same kinds of programmatic structures, going through the same kinds of what I call churchianity experiences. And the end result is that some people don't press through those questions because there's fear of loss, there's fear of retribution. There's a lot of things to overcome. So I really invite people to check out this book if you have not read it, or if you like the audio version, it's outstanding. You did an excellent job in your recording. I really think that it's a worthwhile listen.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a fair question, so I appreciate you asking it.
Yeah. I really want my audience to kind of get past that, right? So, because, Sarah, I don't know how much I've shared a brief synopsis of the work I've done here. Now, I'm kind of a unicorn in terms of the deconstruction movement. I want to kind of get into a little bit of what causes a person to start this deconstructive, self-critical kind of evaluation, right? Where you're kind of looking critically at what's happening, asking fair questions, And then maybe the institutional power doesn't give you a satisfying answer, or it doesn't give you an answer that actually resonates with you. So talk to us a little bit about your journey. I know you've wrote about it in the book, but what are the main things that caused you to get that hiccup, that blip on the radar screen that said, now hold on a minute.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of things that I struggled with. I think, and I talk in the book about the different times I would encounter people in my world who didn't believe what my family believed, and really sort of wrestling with how to think about them. I think that was probably the biggest catalyst. And, I as I describe, I grew up deeply immersed in the church, the predominantly white evangelical church, and there were a lot of wonderful things about that community, but there were things that I struggled with. And I went to Christian school, went to church every Sunday, and sometimes more. My whole world was other evangelicals, and also, even our sort of pop cultural references were kind of this evangelical infrastructure, this media infrastructure. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and so there was Christian TV, Christian radio, Christian textbooks, Christian everything. And I had some exposure to secular pop culture, but not that much, and it was kind of carefully curated. So I started to feel as I got older that I was being maybe given, I mean, every parent tries to guide and shape their children, but I was maybe being given not the whole story, and that the story I was being told, it said things about people I cared about that I didn't necessarily feel were right. So one of the big characters in the book
Your
is my
grandfather.
grandfather,
Yeah,
right?
that one is a great story, by the way.
Who was, one of very few people I knew who weren't in our religious community. And I had this real kind of terror my whole childhood. I was told that he was going to hell if he didn't get saved. And that he was a wonderful, really accomplished, kind person, but not religious. And I struggled with that. I struggled with, as I described several incidents in the book where I meet people of other faiths or different faiths and feel this pressure to convert people. That was always very hard for me. And then I also came to see that some of the things I was being taught in my Christian school and even in Christian college didn't really seem to add up when it came to things like science. I tried really hard to be a young earth creationist, but I just couldn't stay there because of things I learned. And it's really scary though to make those changes. I was warned not to consider those ideas, and I was warned that those were from the devil. But I think, I think for me it was a lot of different things, but it was really trying to resolve these tensions between what I saw and experienced in the world and what I was being told.
Yes, 100% agree. Just so you know, this audience is probably maybe 50 to 55% made up of people who would define themselves as Christian, probably a 25% that would say they're agnostic or atheist, and then another 25% that kind of fill in the holes with either other religious systems of faith, or they're kind of the nebulous, free-floating, spiritual but not religious type person. And many of this audience has been a part of this work for probably 10 years or so. And the whole thrust of this is about, and it's a little different than some deconstructions, but it is how do you get out from under the system and still maintain your faith and still understand, that there are true, real, deep things that happen that are unarguable, and that actually the Bible isn't so black and white as many of our pastors like to teach us. As a matter of fact, applying wisdom to how we interpret it seems to be the best strategy. And when we do that with a good approach with scholarship, not just opinion, we're not just trying to please our district council, we're not trying to please some old church father with whose picture's in the foyer. This is actually a really legitimate examination of historical text, and then trying to apply that message to that group back then to what does that mean in the group tech today? And so that kind of hermeneutical scientific approach to uncovering the biblical message is what we do here. And I found that my audience has really appreciated this kind of approach because it doesn't just leave them out. And I'm kind of curious about some of your experience as you've gone around, you've talked to so many different people. I'm sure after your book signings and other things, people come up, they tell you stories. You obviously have had a pulse on a lot of the deconstruction movement. And a lot of it tends to, from my perspective, it tends to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater a little bit. And at least that's my impression of it. So, what would you say about some of that, the movement? Like, once a person gets to this place where they say, well, you know what? I really don't believe that anymore. So I guess I don't believe the whole Bible. So I guess I don't can't trust the Bible. And then that puts me on the outs of this whole system. So I guess I'm not on the end of that system. And you know, the cascade effect. How would you speak to that?
Well, there's a lot there that, and I'll just react to as much of it as I can. I guess,
Sorry about that.
no, that's okay. It's good questions. I mean, and if I don't address something, feel free to ask me a follow-up. But I guess the way that I have dealt with it is, when I look back on the time when I was an evangelical, maybe a fundamentalist too, really in retrospect, there were things that I would admit. And even the people around me who were more devout than I was would admit they didn't know for sure, theological questions or things that just weren't answered, even by their estimation. And so I think that actually that uncertainty and that those blanks and those gray areas are they're always present. You can try to tell yourself that they're not, and you can try to sort of collapse down as many as possible by sort of hanging on to a particular theology or tradition. And I'm not denigrating anyone who does that, but I think that in my own struggles with spirituality, I have read a lot of church history, and I have studied a lot about how the Bible came together, how the church sort of evolved over the centuries and millennia. And I think if there's any big takeaway, it's that Christians themselves have literally warred over what was true at times, many times,
Still
and
going, still going.
still going on. And there's, so there's not, it's not like when you walk away from that quote unquote certainty, like you're walking away from like, here's one clear path and everything else is murky and uncertain. No, I mean, even when you claim to have all the answers, like somebody right next door is going to have different ones, even who might call themselves the same thing that you call yourself. And for me, that's sort of comforting because it's like, well, maybe I'm just being a little more honest about the gray and the things I don't know. And again, I can't get inside anyone else's head, and so I don't know what it's like to be like, oh, I'm really sure I'm this specific kind of theology. I don't know what that feels like because I've never really truly been. But that's how I look at it, and I can't help but notice that the wide swath of ways of being Christian, let alone religious. So that's one part of it. I think you had a question that had something to do with scripture, maybe. I don't know if you want me to
Well,
say
I
more.
mean, it's part of this overall theme, which you are answering quite well, is it tends to, I see a trend in deconstructionist to basically eject from everything, right? And then try and reassemble it. Maybe they have, counseling groups. Maybe they have other kinds of community-focused events. Certainly things that were a part of the system before that now they're kind of trying to reassemble on the outside, but they've now turned their back on the whole thing. Whereas it seems like a more nuanced approach makes sense because, like exactly like you're saying, everybody's had the wise elder sitting around that's like, you know, some of these questions you're not going to get an answer to, and you need to live in the tension, right? And that's really what I was getting at is like from your perspective and your experience with other deconstructionists, do you see that the baby sense, that spiritual component, that connection to God, that connection to faith is lost? Or do you feel like people are holding on to that in some regard?
For the ex-evangelicals, I talked to people with a variety of sort of journeys and places they'd landed. I mean, the common thread was this sort of shared evangelical background and, you know, experience in the evangelical subculture. And then sort of trying to figure out, if you're not that, well, what am I?
Right.
And so I think, you know, some people one that I talked to, you know, have no interest in real, or maybe I, that's not fair. Most people are still very interested in religion. Maybe it's a more academic interest. But some, you know, some wind up being atheists, or many, I think, wind up kind of uncomfortable with church and not wanting to spend time there. Others find themselves in, you know, maybe more progressive religious communities. There's a variety of places people go. I'm really loath to say that, you know, to sort of, I guess, wag my finger at anybody for what they do, because if there's anything that I believe, it's that, or that I've observed, it's just that, you know, how people feel about spirituality, God, church, theology, all of it is, it's so complex, and it seems to be shaped by some combination of probably their internal wiring, their life experiences, certainly their culture and their upbringing. And so I don't really know, like, I mean, I don't want to like tsk tsk like, oh, you gave it all up. I mean, I think for some people, especially some people like, you know, in the LGBTQ community who've been so harmed, you know, you do what you need to do to take care of yourself. And I have a lot of compassion for that. For me, though, I haven't wanted to totally give it up. I feel, you know, and I always kind of try to pair, couch this in this way. For me, I feel that there is something bigger, and I believe in God. I have a harder time getting my head around really, really specific theology, because that feels less obvious. At the same time, I understand why people, you know, struggle with belief in God or don't believe in God. You know, I understand the world is a really difficult place, and I understand that move. It's just not how what feels right to it's not what feels true to me. But it's not something, I don't think it's something that any of us can really prove. So for me, I haven't wanted to walk away from faith entirely. And I think the fact that I have written a whole book about it and think about it so much is indicative of something.
Well, yeah, and especially given the fact that your work lies at that intersection. Politically, religiously, and culturally, I think it just shows that it's a major thread that's pulling on your life. And this is one of the things we're always saying is, you know, if you read the Bible, the biggest news is that, you know, the Christian religion should never have existed. Like, I know that's shocking to people who come from this idea that, you know, God came down and started an alternative religion and then everybody else got it wrong. But it was never intended to be that. And then it's so explicitly clear about how that. So I spend time kind of reteaching people the Bible with a high level of kind of scholarship and culturalization and contextualization, because I feel like it's really important for people to kind of have that handhold, because you don't have to go out into some nebulous, free-floating spirituality if you don't want to. But then a lot of my audience will come and say, "Well, where's your church? Where's your thing? Give me a book, a life, a thing to do, a practice." It's like, no, I'm not going to do that to you. I won't give you a thing. This is between you. Yeah, this is about your faith. And so, anyway, enough of that. I would love to kind of switch gears a little bit and just kind of get your sense on. As you look back over the work that you've done and the feedback that what do you think is the most redemptive part of this coming out and sharing this story that resonates with so many people?
A couple of things, and they're related. I have probably, on average, I would estimate it at least a couple times a week, sometimes more, hear from people who've read the book, who the messages I get on social media and sometimes emails are so, they're all distinct, but they're also so similar. And the message is essentially, you know, thank you for capturing what it's like and making me feel like I'm not crazy. And that means a lot to me, because, you know, I had this sense for a long time, you know, in my 20s, which was, you know, a really a period of trying to figure out what I believed and struggling with, like, sort of my proximity to my childhood and I just had these experiences sometimes, you know, where I'd be somewhere, party or something, and meet somebody who you get to talking and you find out, yo, you both have this evangelical background. And it's like there's so much to talk about. There's almost like this trauma bond and this sense of resonance and commonality, and you know, often the same kinds of struggles with family and sometimes gaps in cultural knowledge or maybe educational experiences that other people might have had. And so I had this sense. Like, I've always felt, especially being in, you know, national media and being somebody who, you know, travels in very different circles than I was raised, I've always felt a little bit like a outsider or a fish out of water. And I guess a lot of people feel that for various reasons. But for me, I've always kind of felt like my background made me a little bit different. And I know that I'm not the only person who has felt that, particularly if they've had to sort of like assimilate into mainstream society, you know, and it's a real kind of journey. And then there's all the sort of spiritual angst and fear that's wound up with that too sometimes. So I've known this for a while, and then when I, you know, started seeing people talking about it more and more on online spaces where, you know, you're kind of free to talk about things and people can kind of find each other. I realized like, oh, there's, you know, there really is kind of a, you know, a movement arguably here with its own language around these ideas. And so I really wanted to try to kind of articulate that, describe it. And it means a lot to hear from people who feel described. The second thing I'll say quickly about that is I've also heard from several like parents of adult children who raise their kids in the evangelical subculture. Their kids are, you know, anywhere from 20s to my age, early 40s usually. And, you know, who've said to me, I've met a few of them at events and I've heard from some of them online, but they said basically, this is really helping me kind of understand my kids have struggled with this. I'm trying to make sense of it too. Sometimes, you know, an older generation that's in their own way deconstructing and usually these folks are still pretty spiritual, still pretty strongly Christian, but they're kind of going, maybe some of the things that I was fed by my religious community were not that helpful. And I just appreciate so much the self-reflection I hear from those parents of adult children and the empathy and the desire to understand. You know, I won't be too specific because I don't want to, you know, but there was one woman I met at an event who talked about having a child who'd come out and how she said, I really didn't handle it well and I'm trying to repair it. And I was just so touched by her, you know, her compassion and her almost repentance.
That's going to be a major wedge. It's kind of like Republican Democrat, right? Are you it's gonna, you know, the whole LGBTQ reality, and the way that the church has handled it, or I would say mishandled it, is a very significant and key wedge, you know, and you just have both sides doubling down, putting their heels down, crossing their arms, giving each other a stink eye, and throwing, you know, bombs at each other. It's really not getting to any kind of a helpful place. And so on both sides, you kind of have that pain body that people have to sort of work through. And man, I've seen the destruction. I've seen it firsthand. And you know, one of my first podcasts that I did back in probably 2005, something around now, 15 maybe. That's it, 2015, was on this very subject, you know. And so that one opened up so many people to this conversation and to understanding kind of these realities. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah,
One
thanks
of
for the question.
Oh man, I have so many things I wanted to ask you. And I know we can't get to all of them because our time is kind of creeping by here. One of the things we talk about a lot in this audience is how literally everything can become a religion. And so you may like, I work in the sciences, right? I do this work completely for free. It's a gift. It's my passion. I give it away. But I work in the sciences in human genetics and cancer not diagnostics. And I can say that, you know, one of the things that happens is people, they often say, well, I left religion. Now I've got science. I'm a logical thinker. I use data-driven analysis. And so science has kind of become the new religion of four. It has its own talking heads. It has its own kind of papal structure. It has its own dogma that if you disagree with, you're going to be ousted. It has, the whole life of sacrifice that you have to lay down to be blessed by it. But that's not just science. It's the same for our businesses, right? No one's going to bestow upon you that big, success emblem unless you bow down and do the sacrifices and the rituals required to be a success in business or whatever. And it's our hobbies. So everything literally is kind of a religion. And so, in that frame of mind, I want to kind of ask you a question. As you kind of processed these ideas about becoming an ex-evangelical, right? As you kind of hit these walls where the theological structures, the way they applied the Bible, the way they tried to control behavior, whatever it is, kind of didn't work anymore. If that gave you a lens that now, when you go out into the world, are you now more able to see the other kinds of religious overreach that might be exhibited in politics, in these social structures, in people's endeavors, in all these other things, where it's essentially saying, well, if you don't do this, you can't have this, right? Just curious.
Something I talk about a lot is I think that while I've written about the community that I came from, I don't think that evangelicals are the only people that are susceptible to essentially groupthink, peer pressure,
Correct.
shunning. I think that's I'm not a sociologist or a psychologist,
Nope.
but from
Every
my
religion.
observation, it
Every
seems to
religion.
be. Yeah, it seems to be an aspect of religion in general, and also, and of course, within most religions, there are different traditions and different people, sort of lean in that direction to different degrees. But yeah, I think it's a pitfall of religion. I think it's just a pitfall of humans. And I think, yeah, there's a in-group thinking, out-group thinking, and it's necessary, right, to police the boundaries of our society or culture to some degree, right? I mean, it's perfectly reasonable to say that, there are just certain ways we don't talk about other people. There are certain ideas that are really harmful and that lead to violence. I think it's important to recognize that. But I also think that there's a human tendency to sort of, I mean, I think you said anything can become a religion, and I think there's some truth in that. I mean, yeah.
There's always a fundamentalist, right? The fundamentalism is baked into everything. Like, I'm a mountain biker, and if you don't do the fundamentals of mountain biking, your mountain biking doesn't work as well. Right. And so, like, there are people that are like, no, just go ride your bike, have fun. Other people are like, no, you got to do it this way. Right. And it seems like no matter where it is, there's always somebody who wants to really hold tightly to those fundamentals without that self-critical examination, which starts to open up the bigger question. And then that actually gets this out of it. One of the examples I like to use is like if you were standing on one side of the earth and then somebody was standing on the opposite side of the earth, and in yours, it's daytime for you, but it's nighttime for them. And you're just arguing back and forth about your reality. And obviously, you could appeal to science, both of you, and prove your case that these two opposing truth claims are seeming to be at war, but it would take somebody to pull back into a transcendent perspective to be able, before you realize that both of those truth claims resolve themselves into something higher and better. And it resolves the tension for both sides because there's something bigger. And I love that metaphor because it kind of gets us out of our little tribal, tiny little tribalisms into this bigger story, which I think you just in your book, it just kind of comes through, especially as you kind of wrap up towards the end. You get into this idea of how do I exist now? And I think that is such a great question. Like how do me and my family now kind of navigate all of these things? I still have family that are a part of the church and still engage. And I'm in a little bit of a different place now, but there's still love there. This isn't the only thing that bound us together. So could you speak a little bit about how you exist now and how people who might be fearing making a transition or finally stepping away from something that they know has been a major problem, like give them a little encouragement there.
Well, for me, I will say it's been difficult at times. There's been a lot of, I think, particularly with my parents, a lot of pain around the fact that I'm not, maybe the person they would have liked me to be. I think I am a person that has tried to live out the best of the values I was taught, however imperfectly, but their beliefs are very important to them, and I don't share all of them. And so that's difficult, and I think that's something that I know causes pain in a lot of families. At the same time, the project of becoming mature, growing up, living life, I think it requires some level of honesty and authenticity, right? And it also requires us to make decisions about how we treat other people. And I came to a place where, for example, I write about my grandfather, not only being a secular person, but coming out very late in life as gay, and the division and tension that caused in our family. And I know my parents loved him, but I also know that they just didn't know how to deal with that. And that not being able to deal with it caused a lot of pain for me and distance for me between my grandfather, who, I wanted to be close to and was really the only grandparent I had for most of my childhood. And so I had to make a decision when I became an adult about how to regard him and how to treat him. And I think that we all have to come to those sort of decision points. We all have to figure out who we are and what we can live with and how we want to be in the world. And I've tried to be as kind and honest as I can be with my parents. At the same time, there have been many, for every sort of loss or changed relationship, there are others that you gain. And I have many people in my life who have been on this journey with me in one way or another, from my siblings to my extended family to my husband. And those, those relationships are gifts, and they're all gifts. My relationship with my parents is also a gift, even as much as it can be challenging sometimes. Something I've talked about a little bit is the fact that I was in a serious car accident last year, and after that, which this was before the book came out, but it was after my parents had seen a lot of the book, and we kind of talked about some difficult things. And it was a difficult year, but which kind of culminated with this really bad car accident in September. And after that, though, I think it's one of those events that kind of reminds you of what really matters and what you do have in common, which is love and family. And I was really grateful to have their support and some, really good time with them after that. They came to visit, spend time with me and with my son, who was also injured in that accident. And so I guess I just share all that to say that there's hope. Like there's I think there's hope if you stay open and kind. At the same time, we cannot control what other people do. And we can't. And so you kind of have to, I think this is a really hard thing to do sometimes, but to sort of hold the boundary of who you are and want to be, and understand that people will react to that however they choose to react.
It seems like just talking to my audience over the years, it's either, well, we're going to avoid that topic, right? They just kind of have a draw a circle around certain things, say, nope, no talking about that. Others will just agree to disagree, kind of similar in that mind. Others kind of settle and say it's as good as it gets. One of the things I'm always talking about as people are kind of working through these realities is like you can actually get into a really, really amazing place, a healed place. And it just takes some, it doesn't have, it's not about changing what the other person thinks or believes. It's a really has a mostly to do with how we think, how we believe, and as soon as some of those kind of frameworks start to alter, it's absolutely amazing where people can go and where they can get to. And so I got a little whiff of that when you were talking about it at the end of the book. I think you concluded it in a very beautiful way, kind of an honest way, transparent way, and is in a non-dogmatic way too, which I think is exactly what is needed for people. They need to kind of come out. I always call it an exile, but it's you kind of come out into this open space. There is a lot of ambiguity and question and uncertainty, and that's actually good. That's going to help you. It's going to make you grow. It's going to make you actually see the world completely different. So, great thoughts on that.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, in my interviews with other ex-evangelicals, I found a lot of those same patterns you described. I mean, I think for some people there's a not talking about certain things or just accepting that there will be limitations on the relationship. And that can be really hard, and different people are willing to accept different limitations. And again, I can't really, I wouldn't want to advise anybody on like, well, what you can on how, exactly how to navigate that, because I think it's so dependent on the personalities involved and the specifics. But I think recognizing that, like, I think the best for me, like getting clear on the fact that I wanted to have a relationship, even if it was imperfect or in some way truncated, even if it wasn't going to be the relationship I always wished it was helpful. And you kind of, and there's like an acceptance in that.
I'm curious, if you were to have a sequel to the book now, after you've met so many people, talked about it, what would it be about?
Well,
Or
I'm working on
maybe another way of saying it is, what's the next emerging question? Like, what's the big, existential question here, after people kind
I
of
mean,
deconstruct?
yeah. I think one thing I'm curious about is and I touched on this, but I think you could probably write a whole other book on sort of where people go next and how they find community in other spaces. Or I've always been kind of fascinated by religious conversion, like the idea of people sort of giving up one entire set of frames and going with another one, which is like a lot less common than just secularization, which is really the big trend. People have already written a lot of books, or a few books at least, on secularization, but it's definitely one a trend to pay attention to, because it's such a, I mean, if you look at the numbers, like especially the younger you get, looking at American generations, people are becoming less and less religious, less and less likely to affiliate. And so how does that change our culture? How does it change our politics? How does it change individuals? There are people who will disagree with me on this, but I'm not sure it's all good. I mean, religion, I will be the first to say, does plenty of bad things, many, many, many bad things, but it also does good things, and that's generally why people stick with it. And one of those good things is about the search for meaning and the search for community. You can't, I think a lot of people would say you can get those things somewhere else. Many people do. But like, I don't know, we're living in a moment when so many of the institutions that have sort of provided the infrastructure for our society seem to be eroding, falling apart, losing respect, often very, it's a justified loss of respect, but nonetheless. And so, like, what that does to younger generations that are growing up and trying to find their way in the world and make sense of it and find, structure for their lives, like, I have so many questions about that.
Yeah,
And I
that
have
would
some
if
concerns too, but I
I
don't know if
would
that's this book.
I would love to discuss that with you if you get to that point. I've written a lot about that. I don't support conversion in a say. Just the presupposition behind conversion is that there is an alternative religion that you must subscribe to, which is obviously not the biblical narrative. It's certainly not Jesus' narrative. But this idea is more of completion, and that this is a gradual evolution process in the heart and mind of a person to kind of basically come home to God. It's not like you start from the outside and you kind of Red Rover, send a sinner right over. It's more of a, what we always talk about here is it's just more of a gradual awakening and a realization that, you know, God is so much closer to you than you are to you, and that just transforms everything from the inside out. And it's a really beautiful experience once people kind of start to catch it. But because we've been so trained to see ourselves as opposed to everything else, we can't ever get into the flow of what it's always been saying, which is like, I'm not you and you're not me, but I'm not other than you either. Like, there's
Yeah.
this really beautiful kind of thing. And anyway, your book gets at a lot of that kind of stuff. At least I was kind of picking up on some of it. And it just, as I was reading, I was really excited. We have about maybe 5, 10 minutes here at the most before we go. I'm curious, like, some of the people that you've talked to, interviews that you've had, they talk about like leaving the church and having to go into kind of religious therapy. What's your thought on some of that? I mean, I know that there are certain traditions that are just darn right abusive. There's really no other term around it. And for, I think, a situation like that, I think a therapy perhaps is the way to kind of deal with a sense of trauma, because the ability for a religion to traumatizes deep, really, really deep into the psychological and spiritual realities of that person, right? But you know, what have you learned about that, and kind of what's your overall sense of whether that's an effective or needed process for people?
I think for some people it certainly is. I mean, if they feel that they have wounds or trauma that they can't get past, and those wounds and that trauma can look different for different people. And not, you know, this is something that I think psychologists will tell you, is not every pain is trauma. But you know, when it comes to religious trauma, based on my research and talking with, again, psychologists and healthcare providers about this, you know, I think that there's like a long-standing idea that religion is beneficial, and there is some research that says that, you know, people who are in a religious community have better mental health outcomes. And so it certainly can be, but it can also be, I mean, like almost any tool in human hands, it can be used for good or bad. And I, you know, from talking to people, I think when a trauma occurs in a religious or spiritual space, certainly when you're talking about things like sexual abuse, or even just some of the, you know, I mean, the trauma that can be associated with, you know, this really black and white hellfire and brimstone kind of view of the afterlife, you know, but like just baked into you from an early age. You know, those kinds of things are, it's, you're talking about situations that are upsetting, traumatic, scary, in some cases violating. And then you layer on top of that the fact that this is happening in the context of spirituality or religion. So it's happening in the context of something that you're told is good for you, is healthy, is you know, maybe that even your very soul and your salvation is tied to you. And so
Well,
there's a lot to tease, there can be a lot to tease out there.
You know, I'm always polling my audience about what are the biggies? Like, what are the non-starters? What are the common themes? And I can tell you, after doing this for more than a decade, the common themes are always the common themes. Now, there's a few fringe ones, but the common ones are, first and foremost, it's by far my most popular downloaded thing, that is the subject of hell. People are so over-identified with what they think is the biblical narrative of hell. But it's really more Hollywood's version, or, you know, Dante's Inferno, than it is the biblical narrative. When you kind of unpack the biblical narrative, people are left scratching their head going, what the heck? I was totally jacked up by my pastor. My Bible teacher, they didn't get that one right. Another one of the big non-starters is this rapture story. Like, everything is coming out of, you know, a theology of, you know, what's called eschatology, right? That, you know, Jesus is coming back any minute. Don't go to a rated R movie. And if you do, you know, gosh, you know, he might leave you behind, you know. And it's like there's so much content to counteract all of that. That's a big one for people, though. Like they really get wrapped around the axle. What other ones are you seeing that obviously the LGBTQ issue, right? That is so polarizing and it brings out literally the worst in both sides because it's never been handled very well. But what other ones do you perceive or have learned about since you've been doing this?
I mean, I think you identified a lot of them. I also talk about a little bit about sexuality and, not just LGBT, but just sexuality generally, purity culture,
Yeah, yes,
and
that's so
gender
good.
roles,
Yeah.
gender roles too, which are kind of connected ideas. I mean, a couple of things. I think for a lot of people raising purity culture, obviously the idea behind it was well intended. It was about helping young people, find healthy relationships and healthy marriages and, experiencing love the way our parents thought God intended it to be, avoiding pain, avoiding heartbreak.
Yeah.
But I think the reality for a lot of people who, grow up steeped in purity culture, terrified of their sexuality, terrified of making a mistake,
Yep.
terrified of angering not only God, but your youth pastor and your parents and everybody else if you cross some line that is kind of ill-defined. There are so many repercussions from that for a lot of people. And for some, it's, maybe they cross a line and they feel so much shame and guilt. For others, it's like, oh, I'm just going to cauterize this whole thing. I'm going to pretend I'm not sexual. And then I'm going to get married and it'll all work out. And it doesn't all work
Yeah,
out for
no, it doesn't.
everybody.
It doesn't.
Particularly, yeah. And then particularly for women, there's this whole other layer of, kind of often really extreme expectations when it comes to modesty, a sense of blame of something, around, sexual assault this is not unique to, or not exclusive to evangelical culture, but I think it's something that purity culture sometimes perpetuates, this idea that if, a woman's violated in some way, if she's a victim of rape or sexual assault, it's in some way her fault if she wasn't, dressed appropriately. I mean, that's kind of an old trope, but I think it's one that's sometimes perpetuated
Yeah.
by purity culture and modesty culture.
Yeah, your
And
stories
so
in the book on that are really good. I mean, it took me back to college. It took me back to so many of those things. I was obviously in the other group. You were in the women's group. I was in the boys group. And so we learned a whole different set of things. But man, it was really well done. It was funny.
Oh, thank you. I mean, the things that you and I, yes, I described some kind of, in retrospect, kind of funny, but also kind of horrible
Yeah.
experiences I had when it came to, my education around modesty and sexuality. And looking back, it's just kind of amazing the things that you
Right.
just sort of take for granted as, well, that's fine.
Yeah,
There's
and
nothing weird about my Christian school teacher modeling slutty clothes so that I
right.
will know not what not to wear.
And getting and the reality is a high view of love, sex, dating, and marriage is not hard to get to. It's just they went about it the whole wrong way. But our time has escaped us, and I would love it if you could tell the audience how they can reach you, get in touch with you, if how they can follow your work, learn more about what you're doing, best ways to get this book, get the audio, get the e-download. Before we hang up, I want to just give you that opportunity to connect to the audience.
Sure. So the book, The Ex-Evangelicals, is available all the typical places that you get books. And I did narrate the audiobook. So if you're a person who likes to listen rather than read, that's a great option. You can follow my work. Probably the best place is Substack. It's just Sarah McCammon, Substack. Google that, you'll find it. And I have kind of a blog called Off the Air, A Journalist's After Hours Thoughts, which is sort of a mix of sometimes my behind the scenes view of like covering the Republican National Convention, for example. Sometimes it's just stupid stuff about what I'm trying and failing to cook or
Yeah.
things I'm reading, things like that.
No, it's really good. I've subscribed. I've enjoyed it. I love when your
Thank
posts come
you.
out. You're a very good, talented writer. It comes out in all the stuff that you put together. Thank you so
Thank you
much
so
for
much.
being on our program. And I hope if you write a sequel, we can talk about it and come back and do another one of these.
I would love that. Well, thanks for having me, Kevin.
Awesome.
Thanks for your great questions. Take care. Bye-bye.